From Texas Public Radio, this is Texas Matters, a weekly radio news magazine that looks at the issues, events, and people in the Lone Star State. Today on Texas Matters, the controversy over a deeply flawed voter fraud advisory from the Texas Secretary of State. And there stands the old calaboose, the forgotten tiny jails from the Wild West days of Texas. This is Texas Matters from Texas Public Radio. I'm David Martin Davies. On Friday, January 25th, the Texas Secretary of State, David Whitley, issued an advisory to county voter registrars saying that there was a significant problem with non-citizens registering to vote and actually casting ballots in Texas elections. The Secretary of State's office said it discovered a total of approximately 95,000 individuals identified by the DPS as non-U.S. citizens on the voter rolls, and about 58,000 had voted in one or more elections in Texas. The Secretary of State's office instructed county election officials to begin a process of eliminating the non-citizens from the voting rolls. But it didn't take long before voting rights advocates pointed out the deep and obvious flaws in these official numbers. These numbers that claim to be pointing out that there's a problem with voting fraud seem to be fraudulent themselves. There is now growing pushback from civil rights organizations calling for answers from the Secretary of State's office about how it arrived at these numbers and why wasn't the data cleaned up before going to the public with a bombshell press release that was certain to trigger hyper-partisan reactions like that of the tweet from President Trump quoting these numbers and calling for tougher voter ID laws. The Mexican-American Legislative Caucus and the Texas Legislature is also demanding answers. Representative Eddie Rodriguez is the chair of the caucus, and he's a Democrat representing Austin.
This advisory that was released by the Secretary of State's office has a lot of flawed data that is causing a lot of problems, mainly for those people that are on that list, I think mistakenly on a list of ineligible voters. There was a minimally, I would say, shoddy methodology, and what it's done is caused a lot of problems for our local elections officials who are having to go through this list, actually do the job that the Secretary of State was supposed to be doing. And they're finding out that many people on these lists shouldn't be on these lists on the list because they're eligible voters.
And when you say many, we're talking about a substantial proportion of what was produced by the Secretary of State's office.
Correct. I mean, I think there was a report of one county, I believe it was Montgomery County, I could be wrong about the county. There were 400 and plus people on the list, and turned out that every single one of them actually was eligible to vote. So the methodology, from best I can tell, was that the Secretary of State went through the voter rolls and compared it with DPS over the last 22 years, and to look at people who had applied for driver's license who were not citizens, and that are people that are here legally, but that they need a driver's license to be able to drive while they're here, a green card or just a legal residence for to work or whatever it is. But during that period of time, any one of these people could have become citizens, and it turns out that a vast majority of the people on this list actually had become citizens. So they didn't take it to – they took no effort – to remove the U.S. citizens from the eligible voters. And really the problem is they provided this list to the secretary, or rather to the attorney general, the state's top cop, before even looking, really looking and taking a deeper dive into this list. And the AG, I think, made a political calculation. This is newsworthy, not accurate, but newsworthy, and basically stated that there are potentially 95,000 people who are not eligible to vote.
The Secretary of State's office produced this advisory. It runs over to the Attorney General's office. Florida went through a very similar circumstance where the state took two lists, compared them, just like they did in Texas, or we think they did in Texas. We don't have a lot of information about the mythology here, but they were able to find basically the same thing, that there were it was flawed. And also, according to a Miami Herald investigation, they concluded that 58% of those that were targeted in these lists were Hispanic.
Right.
So does that concern
That's
you?
That's exactly what this is. Absolutely. I mean, listen, we've sent out, I have as the policy chair, and there's a policy committee that was established to not only to look at this issue, but just throughout the session to look at issues that affect the Latinos in Texas. We sent four different open records requests from all kinds of communication the Secretary of State has had with the Attorney General. We've done the same thing, open records requests to the Attorney General, DPS, as well as the Governor's Office. And we're in the process of sending a letter out as a committee on behalf of the Mexican American Legislative Caucus to all the various county elections officials, telling them that this advisory is inaccurate. This advisory in the list is inaccurate. That they don't have to provide any of this information. Certainly don't have to provide letters to individuals that are on that list. Which I believe, since these lists are proven to be very inaccurate, it's tantamount to a voter intimidation. I mean, if you're a citizen of this country and you get a letter saying prove your citizenship, you know, we think you may be voting illegally, that's intimidating. And we're encouraging the county elections officials to hold off on sending letters. We know that at least one county has, I believe it's Galveston County, has sent letters out. We're encouraging the other counties not to do so until this can be fixed.
So this is not a benign mistake where this...
No, not at all.
This is...
I do believe that this is very much politically motivated. I believe if you look at just kind of the timing of these events, you have this advisory comes out from Secretary of State late on a Friday. The Attorney General sent something out almost immediately. The President of the United States starts tweeting, which is not unusual. And then on Monday, a bill is filed in the Senate that requires a proof of citizenship before you register to vote. And there's a 2 days later, an identical House bill filed to do the same thing. This is coordinated. There's no doubt in my mind. But I think with these open records requests and the information that we get, we'll be able to prove that. But in the meantime, we're not going to let up on this. The right to vote is one of the most important things, rights that we have as citizens. And I don't know if it's intentional on the part of the Secretary of State or intentional on the part of the Attorney General or both, but to have that happen, and for us, you know, to happen probably to predominantly Latinos in Texas, we have to fight this to the bitter end.
It's one thing for the Attorney General to be acting in a very partisan way, although unfortunate, we know, you know, what Ken Paxton is and what he's all about. He's a politician. But the Secretary of State's office, is that supposed to be different? Is that supposed to be really an impartial office that calls, you know, balls and strikes as an umpire and really tries to maintain fair and open elections in Texas?
Well, it is an appointed position. I mean, appointed by a political figure, the governor. But again, that person doesn't run as a Republican or a Democrat. So I think it is a little bit different. And they're the gatekeepers in terms of our voting rights. So I think it's a little bit different. The Attorney General, whether it's Ken Paxton or whoever is Attorney General in the past and the future, runs as a Republican or a Democrat. So it is inherently a partisan position, although even the Attorney General should call balls and strikes, right? He's a top cop. But at the same time, I don't think that the Secretary of State kind of falls in the same category because of the fact that he or she is appointed and the purview involves voting rights. And that's kind of a different ballgame.
So we expect more from the Texas Secretary of State's office.
Well, we should. Well, we should, definitely. I mean, I think this is just the Secretary of State, whoever it is, can do better than this. And it doesn't take a whole lot. It's one extra step. It doesn't even take a whole lot to really think that, okay, over the course of 22 years, can there really be this? Is it possible that some of these people that asked for a driver's license that weren't citizens have since become citizens? It's not. That's maybe one extra step to do that. But instead, what the Secretary of State did is release this. I believe in a politically motivated way, and maybe in conjunction or in communications with the Attorney General, has put all of this work on our local county elections officials to go to comb through this stuff, which really the Secretary of State should have done, and send an advisory to have the local elections officials send a letter out telling people that they may not be eligible to vote. And sure, you're a citizen, but prove it. I mean, that's just wrong.
Are you losing faith in the Texas Secretary of State Whitley in being able to carry out his duties in a fair and impartial way?
I think I'd like to hold judgment on that until we get some of the data and records that we're looking for that we've asked for as a caucus. I'd like to comb through that really take a deep dive in that data. I think if we see that there was a concerted and politically motivated effort to disenfranchise voters, then I think that we have to revisit it then.
Since the advisory was put out and it has not been rescinded, it is still out there, there's been not a whole lot of answers coming from the Secretary of State's office about how they arrived at these astronomical numbers and whether or not they will rescind or revise, or we don't know. Is that a concern?
It is a concern. We're requesting that he rescind that, and we're going to put a lot of pressure on the Secretary of State to do so. Just for fairness purposes, I mean, you rescind it. You know, if you have a list, make sure to go through it, check it twice, three times. Make sure you're sending in a list that actually nobody wants. People that are not eligible to vote. Nobody wants that. But if you're going to send this list, make sure that you do your job and have the due diligence to send a list that you feel like is accurate. So I think it's important that he rescind it. In the meantime, we're going to do our part as a caucus to communicate with every single county and let them know that this is an advisory. This isn't something that you absolutely have to do. That we are working to try to get some more accurate list together. If that accurate list means like one person in a county, so be it. But I think it's the right thing to do for him to rescind the advisory.
So it's 2019. We came out of the 2018 elections in Texas. We started to see the red wall in the state start to show some cracks. Some people are wondering if 2020 is going to be a big year of flipping of seats and things in the state. So this will be Texas will become a swing state. Do you think that there's going to be a lot more activity in Texas similar to what we're seeing now in order to make it more difficult for certain parties to vote?
I absolutely believe that. I think there's no question about it. And I'm glad you asked the question before I was about to say it. That's absolutely right. I mean, most of these people you're going to prove have Spanish surnames. You're going to see that most of these people that are on this list, I haven't seen a list myself from my county here in Austin, Travis County. But most of them, I assure you, have Spanish surnames. I bet you the vast majority of them are Latinos. The Latinos came out in larger numbers this election cycle. Democrats picked up 12 seats. That is not lost on the Republican Party. That is not lost on the Attorney General, and probably not lost on the Secretary of State. So, yes, if you look at this past election, a midterm election to get 12 seats, you know, Democratic seats in a seemingly, you know, solidly red state is a scary proposition for Republicans. So I think this kind of underhanded way of trying to disenfranchise Latino voters is going to continue. So we have to be really diligent, watch what these, not only the Secretary of State, but watch what the Republican Party and other elected officials in the Republican Party are doing, because I think they see that things could be changing. You know, finally, I think demographics and the politics of one Donald Trump is catching up with them, and they're going to try anything they can to minimize the bleeding.
So you think this could be the precursor to a voter purge in Texas, similar to what we saw in Florida and Georgia in the 2018 general elections, and which may have tipped the balance?
Yeah, it could. It could be. It could be a beginning of an attempt. I will say this: I will give the Mexican American Legislative Caucus a lot of credit, if I may say, of catching this and looking at it and really taking a lead on it early. We're not going to let up. We're going to shine a light on this. And you know, we're gonna fight this tooth and nail. Absolutely, this is something that you know is not going to go unnoticed or unchecked or unchallenged. And you know, we'll just have to see how it goes throughout the session. I think Tuesday is going to be a big day. If you're paying attention to the governor's State of the State address, which I will be, I'll be in the House chambers listening to it. And if he mentions this advisory, then I think it's game on. If he kind of, you know, tones down or doesn't mention it at all, then perhaps, you know, we're being successful in highlighting and shining a light on how inaccurate this list is, how politically motivated it is, and perhaps we'll slow it down.
So those bills that have been filed, that came, I guess, as a reaction to this advisory from the Secretary of State's office, Do they have legs? What's going to happen to them? I mean, still the Republicans control both houses and the governorship.
Mm-hmm. No, I mean, I think because of the Republican majority is as small as it is now in the House. I mean, there's a chance, certainly. But I think that one of the reasons why I've supported Dennis Bonin as Speaker was because I know that Dennis Bonin has the interests of the body as a whole at heart. He loves the House of Representatives. He doesn't like when the House is divided. That has been divided for minimally the last three sessions. We have closer to parity now in the House. A bill like this would just cause a lot of friction and fighting on the House floor if it gets to that. And I trust that Speaker Bonin doesn't want to see the members cut each other up on an issue that's based on flawed data. You know, so I have to have a little bit of hope that with our new Speaker and what he's expressed to all of us is that he wants the House to work together, and this would be an issue that will just tear us apart.
And we should remember that this is a democracy, right? People who are eligible to vote should be allowed to vote.
Absolutely.
You got to wonder if both parties still believe in that principle.
Well, I do think, I can speak as a Democrat. I believe the Democratic Party believes in that principle. And I believe that most Republicans, my colleagues, do as well. So we'll just have to see how that resonates, you know, how that rings true. I mean, I think asking people, if you have to ask people, if either of these bills pass, I'm just talking about the ones that require proof of citizenship before you register to vote. I mean, that could be an offensive question that you'd ask to any American, right, to any Texas citizen, right? I mean, it's not going to just be asked. They're not going to look at your skin tone and say, hey, you know what, before you register, you know, prove that you're a citizen. Well, of course, if that's the case, then that's unconstitutional. So that means you're going to have to ask everybody. And I'm not sure if Texans have an appetite for being asked to prove they're a citizen before they exercise their franchise.
Representative Eddie Rodriguez is the chair of the Mexican-American Legislative Caucus in the Texas legislature. He is calling out the Texas Secretary of State, David Whitley, to answer questions about a deeply flawed advisory to Texas county election administrators, claiming there are 95,000 non-citizens in Texas who are registered to vote. A review of the data shows that number is not correct. In Texas, during the days of the Wild West, if a cowboy got too rowdy or if an outlaw got himself cuffed, they would be first locked up in the local calaboose. These were tiny, frequently one-room makeshift jail cells that could be seen as medieval, and many still stand today. They are peppered across Texas in small towns, often forgotten about, but they caught the eye of William E. Moore, and he wrote the book, The Texas Calaboose and Other Forgotten Jails.
That project started by accident. We were in a small town called Gauze between Hearn and Cameron to look at an old house that had, you know, very interesting house. And then we drove behind this row of brick buildings to visit a cemetery. And we spotted this concrete building that I had never seen before. And from a distance, we made comments like, what is that, you know? And we got up to it, and it had bars in the window, and we ran into a local who said that was their jail back in the 20s, and that's the first one I'd ever seen, and it just got me interested, and then the more of these I found, the more I wanted to pursue it.
Calaboose, that's a great word.
It is. Calaboose is a word that I had heard as a youngster watching Western movies, but never gave any thought to what it meant except a jail, you know. But it actually comes from a Spanish word, calabosa, which also means jail or dungeon. And when you look at historic maps, the tiny jails are most often referred to as a calaboose, and the larger two-story county jails are always referred to as a county jail. And so that word is definitely associated with smaller jails.
So it's amazing that you were able to find so many of these calabooses still in existence.
Yes, I was surprised at that because at first I thought I would just maybe find a few here and there and maybe write an article for a journal, as I want to do. But then they just started popping up more places, and I just kind of took it on myself to find as many as possible, and I ended up with quite a few.
So how were they used?
If you talk to a local about their calaboos in their town, the comment you get most often is, oh, that was just a place to lock up drunks, you know. Now, the vast majority of people in a calaboose were there because of intoxication, fighting, rowdy behavior, that sort of thing. That's documented. But they were the local jail for the town for any offender. Most of the small towns didn't have a police force, or the sheriff might be 30 miles away with, you know, back in those days, no roads. You know, transportation would be really precarious, especially in bad weather. So they were and could be considered a holding facility for the serious criminals until they could get them to the county.
And this is Wild West stuff we're talking about.
Well, I guess so. They're all over Texas. And so, I mean, they're in East Texas. And I don't know if you'd refer to that as the Wild West, but a period of lawlessness and the calabooses appear on historic maps back in the 19th century also. But the period that most of the ones that are still standing that I focused on, that I could find, are from around that latter part of the 19th century through about the 30s or 40s of the 20th century. And so they served a purpose at that time, and they were very, very common. And then my theory is because they seem to not have been used much later than the 40s. There are a few examples where some were used much later periodically, but it's my theory that when the Farm to Market Road Act was passed, and in the 30s when better roads were built, and people could get from their small towns to the county and had better vehicles, the need for a local calaboose no longer existed.
What does a typical calaboose look like?
Okay, there is no typical calaboose. I mean, there was like no formula on this is how you build one. Okay, but I map all of these to scale and describe the floor plan because there are variations. The two most common floor plans are one empty room with a door in the front, a one door, and then windows could be of any size and anywhere. They may have one window or four windows. That's not a rule. Then the other most common type is a structure that has two cells side by side, a wall in the middle dividing the cells, and two doors that open to the outside. And they were made of wood, stone, brick, concrete. So whatever materials it was expedient at the time for the town, because these small towns often didn't have lots of extra money, and they would use whatever they could. There is a calaboose that I have found in Oklahoma that used a door from an old bank vault. So they must have torn down the bank and said, hey, let's just use this. Why buy a door, you know, that sort of thing. So you see lots of interesting things like that.
So typically they seem to be freestanding, most of them?
Yes.
And about the size of a shed?
Okay. Now, since there's no actual definition, the word calaboose simply means jail. So there's no formal definition that you can look up the word calaboose and say, okay, here's what one is. So for my purposes, I had to create a definition. Otherwise, readers would say, you missed the one in my town, this sort of thing.
Right.
So I came up with a definition of 300 square feet or less, one story. And anything above that, there's what I would call like a transition in size or between 300 square feet and some of the bigger jails. And so in my book, I have a chapter on small jails that are a little too large to fit my calaboose definition, but they're also very small by most standards. And they're in there partly because they're little known and probably wouldn't be documented by somebody else later. For example, there's one in Trinity, Texas. It's not in great shape, but it's a really unusual building, and it's I doubt that anybody would ever write about it. So,
but anyway. I think that's one that's like connected to another building. It's like an old. It's like a shell of a building now. It's a brick building.
Yes.
And but it's interesting how these things still, you know, the structures are still there. They have been, haven't been knocked down, and people, I guess, have formed some sort of as a community, as a communal consciousness, multi-generational, an attachment to these buildings, and probably have a lot of stories.
Yes. Some of the communities have realized that that little calaboose in their town is an important part of the history of the town, and they have decided to preserve it. Other towns have not recognized the potential importance of this building, and they have torn them down. I don't know how many existed at one time, but I based on map records and stuff, there were quite a bit. And I suspect there was probably at least one in every county, but I haven't been able to find a standing one in every county. But they certainly were very, very common. And I looked at hundreds of newspaper articles talking about calabooses being built and how they were used. And the one up in Kemp, Texas, in northeast Texas, Bonnie Parker spent a night in that one. And there's lots of Bonnie and Clyde stories where people said they saw them, but this is documented. She was actually one night in that jail.
You think there's a bunch more calabooses across Texas that you've yet to find? You're still looking?
Yes. In fact, since my book was published, I have been told by other people of at least three or four, maybe five, that I didn't know about.
And
there's some I know about that aren't in the book because they either on private property and the owner didn't want it in there, or I couldn't get a good picture, or for various reasons they're not in there. So there's quite a few that are not in the book.
Why have you gone through all of this trouble? Why have you chased these calabooses? What is it about them that has just become a purposeful endeavor?
I want to see them preserved. So my what I want readers to come get from my book is, hey, these are very interesting little buildings. I didn't know they existed. Let's go look at one. And maybe a town, a small community somewhere will say, you know what, we've got something special here. Let's promote it. You know, and the city of Caldwell is doing that. They have a really nice a calaboose there, and they've put a nice fence around it, antique-looking fence, and they're going to make it available, you know, on the weekends, I say, so tourists can go look inside and everything, and maybe you have some public events there. You know, maybe school kids can go there. So I just want to see them, at least have people become aware that they are there and let them form their own opinions, what they think of them.
William E. Moore is an archaeologist. He's the author of several books and articles about Texas history. His latest book is The Texas Calaboose and Other Forgotten Jails. It's published by Texas A&M University Press. That's it for this edition of Texas Matters. Thanks for listening. I'm David Martin Davies. You can write to us with an email to texasmatters@tpr.org. You could also write directly on our show page on our website at tpr.org. And that's where you can listen to past Texas Matters programs, and you can download us wherever you get your podcast. And tune in again next week for another edition of Texas Matters from Texas Public Radio.